I always tell everybody when you get up in the morning and you think you don't want to do it, I do the same thing with myself. I tell myself to do the first set. After that, I still don't want to do it, then I'll stop. 10.9% of the time, or 99.999% of the time, after the first set, you're so motivated, you're like, I'm going to finish the workout.
If you want to get stuff done, then you have come to the right place. This is the Get Stuff Done podcast, brought to you in association with RDI Worldwide, a weekly interview series with prominent and diverse people from around the world who will share their own unique insights on what it takes to get stuff done and their personal strategies for doing so. My name is Gordon Dudley, the creator of the Get Stuff Done project and host of this podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope you enjoy this episode and would love to hear your feedback anytime. Let's get stuff done. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Get Stuff Done podcast. I'm joined today by Kunal Bhagat, who is a consumer tech entrepreneur with a successful exit. He built, sold, and indulged beverages, a category leader in the single-serve coffee tea space in India. He began his career working in investment banking for Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and also Barclays Capital, and has a substantial track record in private equity at Dar Capital, originating transactions in excess of $2 billion cumulative. He was also the chief executive officer of Vida Acquisition Corp, an edtech focused in SPAC, and most recently was heading up the setup of a $1 billion plus family office, as well as serving on the board of some other companies. He has also worked with the chairman of Education First and served as a director in some other organizations as well. He holds an MBA from INSEAD, and I think that he has an immense amount to talk to us today about getting stuff done, which is why I wanted to have him as a guest. So, Kunal, thank you so much for being our guest today.
God, thanks for having me.
So, I mean, it's quite a substantial introduction I gave you there, and I even cut some things out, which I'm sure we can kind of get into. But right now, tell us a little bit about what you're up to at this time.
Really interesting you mentioned that, Gordon. As when you and I had that private conversation, I mentioned that resigned from my role for various reasons earlier in the year. I won't get into it too much at this juncture because of various legal ramifications. Yes, at the moment, I'm having very interesting discussions regarding future projects that I might undertake with various companies, which are the conversations of me potentially joining them. Apart from that, I am working on a couple of projects which I'm consulting a couple of large organizations on various aspects of their strategy going forward.
And so, I think the majority of people in this world, they are living paycheck to paycheck. They are waiting for that monthly salary to come into their account, and that's how they are going by things. But from speaking to you before, you have surpassed that, and you are now somebody who has, let's say, more freedom to do what you want to do, to allocate your time as you wish. I'd like to get to know, at what point in your career did that balance tip from being, let's say, a salary man to being, an investor, obviously an independent entrepreneur as you are now?
I think the balance tipped a few years back. I think it's just accumulation of capital over my working career. I think there are facets to it, right? I mean, for everybody there, unless I think you're a multi-billionaire, you never quite reach that point because your aspirations far exceed
your current
levels of wealth. And I guess it's the same for me, like everybody else. However, it takes the pressure off from being compelled into a role that one may not enjoy. So it gives me the freedom and flexibility to indulge in all these possible conversations and sift through them and pick the ones which would really excite me going forward. Because if you want to commit the majority of your waking hours to a project or a company or an entity or a fund over the next few years, it might as well be something you are excited by, which gives you that impetus to get up in the morning and get things done, get stuff done. So I think that's where I am at the moment, where I am having a lot of discussions. There are a couple which seem interesting, and I'm hoping to continue and exploring those two or three options where at least the initial assessment seems that they will be that will be rewarding going forward. Not just financially, but also in terms of giving me a sense of accomplishment and fulfillment and really exciting and there being a lot for me to learn.
Yeah, I get that. I think you've got to make the choices which will make you fulfilled, but also the most efficient and effective allocation of your time. At what point did you transition from, like, what made you take the leap to become an entrepreneur and that journey of setting up that business that you did? What did you do that from a position of relative safety? Or was it actually, you know, some people obviously go into entrepreneurship from necessity, and then other people have an opportunity which is just too big to kind of pass on. How about yourself?
It's a very interesting point you bring up. I must say there wasn't, by then I'd reached a stage where it wasn't a necessity, and there was sufficient capital built up that in case things didn't work out, I would be fine for a while.
Okay.
We did, my wife and I, she was my girlfriend then, we were quite keen to get something of our own going. In fact, we'd been talking about it for a while. So we planned for this. So I put in my papers when we were sure we had the necessary capital base, number one. Number two, we had been looking for an idea behind which to put in all our effort. And then we think we stumbled upon one. And when I say stumbled is, you know, because it's a combination of a lot of research, but also hearing something, you know, sometimes just serendipitously something pops up in your sort of in your horizon or in your in front of you, and an opportunity and all that hard work and research sort of come together in a, and that's what ended up happening for us. So we came upon this idea of setting up a single serve coffee and tea company in India, very similar to what Nespresso does here. Of course, we, at that point in time, there was still not a lot of e-commerce. Nespresso wasn't really available online. When we went to India, and while Nespresso was available, it was not available through official channels, but we could. But the writing was on the wall. India was getting richer. People were, you know, it was urbanizing. People were moving to the cities. And you know, domestic help, which is quite a common part of most middle-class upwards households, was getting more expensive. Mm-hmm. So this product sort of seemed to hit all the right buckets. We, of course, innovated to add a tea capsule also, which I hadn't heard of at that point in time anywhere in the world. So we hired a bunch of industrial engineers, got going, and then, you know, eventually we launched the company. But yes, the, to cut a long story short, the process, we were looking for something. We had a safety net by then. We did. The reason we chose India is because, you see, at that point in time, all that one ever heard about were the BRIC countries. It wasn't as yet BRICS. It was BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And me being Indian, it just was the natural choice out of those four to move to set up this business. Mm-hmm. We had considered Russia and China also, but, you know, for obvious reasons, we stuck with India. And well, the rest is history.
Okay. And in the context of getting stuff done, obviously the name of the podcast, how different is it for you when you're starting something like that in terms of what you are looking at and focusing on a daily basis versus, say, a pure investment project or even just being an employee with a large organization?
I think some my experience, right? I was a first-time entrepreneur. Then I hadn't done anything. So I think it was, I learned a lot also what I needed to get done. But I think having been in banking and more importantly, having been in private equity, had in the last, just before I quit Dar Capital to go start this, I did get an opportunity to work with some entrepreneurial families, some first-time entrepreneurs, as well as families where maybe they were second or third generation down. But I did get an understanding of what it entails. So when I got started, and maybe coming from the background I did, everything was quite properly laid out and planned, you know, the various steps. And of course, some of these steps weren't required and some additional steps needed to be sort of done. But I think the roadmap I had laid out from, you know, from the day we decided to get this project going to the day we launched the product, a lot of the steps were already mapped out. Of course, we had to pivot dramatically in the middle a few times, but I think that helped give a sense of direction and sort of guide us as to what needs to be done on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, what our objectives were. And one of, and just before I wrap this up, and then I tell every entrepreneur, we got a very good bunch, and maybe these days you don't need it so much because there's so many things available through third parties and through maybe ChatGPT and other generative AI sort of models. But I had a very good bunch of lawyers and accountants from day one. So everything was very properly documented and set up, which really helped us down the line.
I have heard that from other entrepreneurs, is that the, yes, they are expensive, but they are relatively cheap for the risk factor and making sure that things go through as you intend them to be, and ultimately can cost you far more when things go wrong. So yeah, I think you definitely share that point of view with others who have kind of followed that path. And so then what was the time period or that you were fully involved in your business to then get to a point of exiting?
We started working on various ideas middle of 2011. 2012 beginning is when we decided this was the idea we are going to focus on. I moved there beginning 2012. My wife moved there middle of 2012. We got married then and she moved to India. She followed me 6 months later. And she left the business 2014 just because we were getting bigger and now we had a big team in place and it just was becoming awkward for us, for both of us to be involved. And we thought it was better for our marriage that we are, you know, otherwise the delineation between the bedroom and boardroom is very, very, there is no delineation. So, you know, often a professional squabble can become a personal squabble. So we took this conscious decision of her exiting the business and, you know, she had incredible job offers already lined up. So it was an easy step for her to step out. And then we exited the business in 2017, middle of 2017.
That's what they do say. There is a lot of advice that says you should not mix family and business or, you know, people that you love with. But it sounds like you had that intention from the start, like you went in that way. But you found a way that to avoid any troubles in that respect. I'm curious, was that something that you realized along the way, or did you always envisage that there would be a point in time where we need?
I think, look, at the end of the day, a lot of these things, they weren't that well thought out or planned. So Elena, my wife Elena, she dipped in and out of the business. So initially when we started, she was very involved with the idea that we decided to pursue. Then there was a point in time when I was setting up, you know, when it's very heavily focused on operations, getting the company up and running, trying to raise funding, etc., which played more to my skill set than hers. Mm-hmm. She got involved a year down the line more seriously when we were getting ready to launch our products because she has a background in branding and branding strategy. And then she was involved. So the names of the name of the brand, the name of our various blends, etc., all were Elena's brainchild. And then as we got more professional, and then I attracted a co-founder who was really, really capable and is obviously one of my best friends today. And he came on, he brought some of the same skill set to the project. And then we felt for the sake of the business and for the sake of the marriage, it made more sense for her to pursue an independent path.
Got it.
And me to continue with the business.
For me, to add my personal perspective, my wife is in a totally different field and we are both in full agreement that if we were ever to start working together, it would be the end of our marriage very, very rapidly. So we're totally happy. We're totally happy just doing our own thing and separately understanding that we're very different people. We're very happy, but working together would not be a good idea. We're both in agreement on that.
But you know what, Gordon, in the world we live in today, these skill sets are so fluid and our experiences, you know, there's so much overlap that I think even when you're in two different fields, you never know where they marry up. For example, if I look at us, you know, I was in private equity and my wife was in branding. You would never have thought we would end up working together, but it ended up happening.
That's true.
And that was not the first one. We did look at another project. We started another project together a few years down the line after selling Indulge Beverages. we started a company called Glowjar, which was an artificial intelligence-driven platform, which would basically scan a person's face and would mm-hmm. come up with recommendations for skincare. We did raise capital for that company also, although we returned it and decided not to pursue it. We thought maybe we were a bit ahead of our times then.
Okay. Yeah, well, timing is everything in every sense when it comes to business. So getting stuff done, you know, various levels of doing that, personal basis, organizational basis. But for you, like on a daily basis, kind of, you know, obviously you have already accomplished a lot. There's no doubt about it. Your track record speaks for itself. So can you share a little bit about what you think are some of that your techniques, strategies, methods for getting, you know, everything done that you hope to and more?
First of all, let me preface this by saying you're being extremely kind and magnanimous, but answering answering your question, I think I'm a firm believer in this philosophy that, you know, humans only have a finite capacity to make decisions. So a lot of my day is pretty routine, except for the fresh things that need to get done. So what time I get up, what my morning is, you know, my workout, my coffee, the clothes I wear. I have only like 5 different t-shirts and multiples of those, so that I'm never trying to decide which t-shirt I'm wearing or shirt or whatever. I have like this t-shirt and like I have 6 which look exactly the same.
Okay.
I think and what I eat for breakfast, lunch, dinner is pretty much, unless I'm going out, is the same day in and day out. So there is no decision fatigue. So what I tend to do is, for each day that I know what I need to do, I tend to make on Google Keeps these lists, which mm-hmm. pops up as a reminder first thing in the morning. And during the day, basis on what I'm doing, basis what I need to achieve over the week or month, I keep putting these early morning reminders for the day something needs to get done. So in the morning when I get up, you know, the task list generally automatically pops up for me what I need to get done today. And then it makes it fairly easy to focus on those tasks. You know, there's no noise around some of the usual stuff that you need to get done in life, you know, just to exist. So all of that is so automated that it frees me up to focus on these tasks.
Got it. And it's very interesting that you've taken that conscious decision to do like that. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg also famously also does the same thing, always wears the same thing every day to specifically avoid that brain energy involved in making a decision, which doesn't help. So that's interesting. You also mentioned fitness there. For those who are just listening on the podcast, you don't have a chance to see that Kunal is displaying a very muscular physique. So clearly fitness is also a big part of your life. Tell us a little bit about how you manage that side of your life.
Look, I've been at it for over 30 years now. So it's, you know, I've put in the time. So what I realized fairly early on, and of course, you know, every year or every 2 years, there's a complete change in fitness philosophy, what you need to do what you need to do in diet, what you need to do to maximize muscle growth or hypertrophy. And you need cardio, you don't need cardio, you need long distance, you need short intense bursts. I've only done what I found enjoyable and what I felt was something I could stick with. Of course, when I was in college or, you know, in my early 20s, I spent maybe a bit, I did the usual stuff in the gym in terms of lifting weights and hanging out in the gym with my friends, and so spending an hour and a half because it was also social. Mm. But given that life gets busy, now I have a routine which I've followed for the last 20-25 years, and it takes barely 20-25 minutes, especially for the last 15 years. I've been very consistent with this routine. It takes between 20 to 30 minutes, and I do it every morning as soon as I get up. I have my coffee, I do that, and it's out of the way. It's as routine for me as brushing my teeth, and I very rarely miss a day. So it's generally 300 days out of 365 minimum in a year. But that's it. And if I think I can't get the whole 25 minutes in for some reason, like, for example, when I was working with EF, I would leave London at 11 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, land in Shanghai at 6 in the morning. So I barely slept. I would go to the hotel room, still get 15 minutes in, get showered and go to the office. So something gets done. So okay. I have broken it down into ideal scenario and time press scenario. And the time press scenario takes between 10 to 15 minutes. And there is really no excuse that it can't get done. So that's what I've been doing for a very long time now. And I guess it's just, there is no other secret. It's just consistency.
But the intensity at which you're working out must also be relatively high, because, you know, I think your physique speaks for itself in that, you know, clearly you are doing something very intensive in your workout.
Yes, it's only strength training I do, and it's only like one day I do a push routine, and one day I do a pull routine, and okay. I use bands, and I only do one set per exercise.
Okay.
To total failure, but I've been using bands, and you know, now bands have become quite the sort of, you know, now they're very in, everybody's talking about them.
Very,
you know,
trendy.
Athletes are using
yes.
them, UFC fighters are using them. And the thing is, I've always felt, you know, when I used to look at it logically, how the hell can muscle know the difference? The stress is the stress, right? I mean, whether it's coming from your body weight, or it's coming from a band, or it's coming from weights, it's the same
thing. Yep.
So yep. I've always used a combination of weights, bands, body weight. I find bands are much tougher. So if I'm traveling and the hotel has a great gym, I'll go and do it in the, you know, I'll use weights. But it's the same principle. One set, done and dusted, and you're out.
Okay.
And somebody says, oh, maybe you're leaving some gains on the table. And I said, maybe I am, but I'm not a bodybuilder. I just do it for fun. So it's and over a 30-year period, there is nothing left on the table. You know, you've maxed out.
Never miss a day. I love that. I love that. I'm signed up for High Rocks, the fitness race coming mm-hmm. up in December. So I'm going to be preparing for that with, you know, increased intensity compared to what I've been doing over the summer since transitioning back to the UK, where I was not quite so focused. I think I need to take a leaf out of your book. It doesn't matter where you are or what you're doing, you still need to make that, even if it's a short time. I think that's the key point, that even a small amount is already that infinitely better than doing nothing. So yeah, I think that's going to be a takeaway for me. And so do you feel that fitness and maintaining a high level of fitness has also helped you in your professional career as well?
I think so. I think where it's really helped me is there have been times which have been professionally trying, and I'm sure it's the same for everybody, right? When things are not going your way. And I think what kept me sane and what kept me focused was this commitment to work out every day. And I think that still continues to pay dividends beyond just, you know, what is visual and in terms of physical health. I think it has great mental health benefits, and it keeps me very disciplined in other things in life also, I feel.
It's somehow for me it becomes a almost like a mindset type of altering effect.
Yeah.
It's not direct. It's not that I'm physically fitter, therefore I am better. But definitely for mindset, I find it helps. Yeah. I want to
and for your listeners, I'm going to give one more tip, just because you're talking about something which is very close to my heart, fitness, and I give advice to so many friends and family on this. I always tell everybody, when you get up in the morning and you think you don't want to do it, I do the same thing with myself. I tell myself to do the first set. After that, I still don't want to do it, then I'll stop. 10.9% of the time, or 99.999% of the time, after the first set, you know, you're so motivated, you're like, I'm going to finish the workout.
Yeah. I think that's really, really sound advice. It's not that you, once you've broken down that barrier of the start, of the getting started, then it's plain sailing. So people, when it comes to runners who for going out for a run, don't think about the fact you've got to run 5K, just put your shoes on. Once you put your shoes on, you're out the door, and then you're good to go.
I'll add on another tip. Every night before I go to sleep, and I've been doing this again for 20, 30 years, I lay out my gym wear. And I lay out my bands, which I will be using, because I work out from home most of the time rather than go to the gym.
Right.
And the moment I wake up, before I even brush my teeth, I change into the gym clothes. And then I sit down and do some work and have my coffee. But the fact that I'm already dressed up to go to the, you know, in my workout gear, not gym clothes, workout gear, I think it's very difficult to justify to yourself any excuses after that. So, you know, it's just the chances of me then missing out on anything just get reduced dramatically.
For sure. Yes, you're setting yourself up for success, and you're making it very difficult to not do it.
To back out,
which is which I think psychologically that's very effective. So that's obviously clearly why it works. I want to flip the script around a little bit and ask you about a time where perhaps when you failed to get something done that you wanted to, an accomplishment that you had planned and that you were working towards, and for some reason it didn't turn out as you wanted it to, and how you went about getting back on track.
Absolutely. I'm going to read a quote.
Okay.
Because I've kept this quote with me.
I've done 42 episodes of this podcast, Kunal, and you're the first person to read a quote, which I absolutely love. I'm really looking forward to this.
I'm paraphrasing it a bit, but it's
okay.
Market dynamics trump individual performance, expectations, and effort. So despite everything, I struggled to raise funding for my startup in India initially. And it was really trying. It took, and then I spent a year and a half before I finally gave up on raising funding for my startup. We almost shut it down and moved back to the UK. And it's just one of those things where I just sat down and had to relook at the entire business model and see, what if I was to fund it myself? And a very close friend also put in some capital. What would it entail? Why did I need the capital that I was asking for? And the big reason is to set up the manufacturing plant. And I went back to look at the machinery. Why is it so expensive? And I realized it is so expensive for two reasons. Automation and accuracy. And when I drilled down into it, the accuracy, if you want 5 grams of coffee in your capsule, you're paying so that it never goes below 4.99 and above 5.01. But the reality is, whether it's 4.8 or 5.2, the consumer cannot tell the difference. For example, forget the consumer, the expert can't tell the difference because we tried it. And then I realized, you do that and all of a sudden, the cost drops to barely 10% of the original because you're paying for the accuracy.
Wow.
Then you're paying for automation. But what is cheap in India is labor. And I'm not saying heavy labor. All they need to do is transfer the capsules, which are being made, into and manually boxing them instead of automated boxing. And all of a sudden, another significant chunk of the capital cost disappears. And we made a few more. I'm simplifying it, but I went through the entire production line and we started seeing where the costs were. What were the cost centers? And we redefined the entire production line. And all of a sudden, it cost me barely 5% of the original machinery. Obviously, was it to the standards that, say, a Nespresso would use? Would it be able to produce 20 million capsules per year? And the answer is no. But it was enough for us to get started. And I think so the answer to the question is just perseverance and relooking at the problem from a different angle. But yes, it was a really trying time.
I think that's a fantastic example. Thank you so much for sharing, because what you're saying is that you took accuracy out, you took automation out, but those two items revolutionized the cost and the ability to deliver the project. So that, you know, it's not intuitively obvious.
I would not say I took accuracy out. I took perfection out. You know,
right,
how they sometimes say the what is the quotation, and I might be misquoting, best is the enemy of the good, or what is that quotation? There's something like this, where you're trying so hard for perfection, but you fail to do anything because you're trying so hard for perfection. And I think that was a lesson there.
For sure.
Because we were still getting it fairly accurate. It's just not pinpoint accuracy.
Right. To a degree that was just unnecessary, as you explained, which is, whereas of course the starting point would always be to get it as pinpoint accurate as possible. Whereas actually the question of do we need it to be like that was not asked. And it's something that I advocate a lot through my LinkedIn posts and through this podcast is, you know, getting stuff done is also often just about getting started. I mean, it's similar to what we were talking about with fitness and again with here is that starting, that like you can have the perfect plan, but the one thing that's certain is that plan is going to be affected, you know, over time and will not be the perfect plan that you make now as time goes by. And therefore, there's no such thing as a perfect plan in reality. And much better is to get started and learn along the way and alter and adapt, like you've explained. So that's...
I know it's supposed to be more you asking me questions, but I was just wondering, how does this sort of relate to what your entrepreneurial experience was? Did you end up having a similar sort of experience? Was it tough to raise funding? Was it tough to get customers in initially? How was your journey? I'm curious.
Thank you for asking. I'm happy to also have questions from time to time. For me, I was going into an area that I had not worked in full time at all professionally. Yeah. And I was doing it in a country that was foreign to me, where I did not speak the language fluently. And so I took some time off of work. And I gave myself a very fixed timeline. So it was 150 days of a leave that I took from my job at the time. And that was my time that I was going to decide whether this business is go or no go. Is it viable or not? Yeah. And I did everything I could within that time to make the best decision I could by the end of that 150 days, whether I think that it's going to be able to take off or not. And so what I did is I actually had a kind of a notepad. And I started with 150 written on that. And every day that passed by, I flipped it over. So it was going down. So I kept myself very time aware that time was running out on this on this 150 days. I mean, because 150 days in some sense is a long time. You can do a lot in 150 days.
Yes.
On the other hand, it's a few months, and you can absolutely allow a few months to pass by and get nothing done. Time is that kind of unusual friend of ours. And so I got to the end of that 150 days, and I felt confident enough with also the backing of another friend of mine who was going to relocate to Korea and join me to start. So we were going into it together. That gave me some additional confidence that we could start it. And so that's how we started. 2016, I went back to the company and resigned, and we started preparing to establish the entity and go from there.
And did it take you long to start getting customers?
Well, we were very aware that we are in a B2B space where the lead time is significantly longer than if we were in the B2C side. And so what we did is we actually went to a slightly less lucrative business, which was on the corporate training side of things, because we could get customers more, you know, it was a lower ticket value. So we were able to get customers quicker that way. And our idea was that we would get in with the customers in this one service and then grow the wallet share into the other more lucrative ones. Turns out that synergy between the two services was non-existent. We really failed to convert customers from one to another. And so over the course
of... That's surprising. I also understand why you would have made that leap of logic.
Yes, but just a different decision-making, purchase decision, a different budget allocation, even though it comes under the umbrella of HR. Hiring and talent acquisition is just so much closer to the business. And what the business needs, whereas L&D, professional development, corporate training is so much more usually for organizations. If there is excess budget or left remaining budget, then let's allocate it to that. It's not unfortunately to say, it's not usually a decision that companies very consistently and constantly allocate budget to that. And so that's where it became, like I say, not a synergy of the two services, and we had to run them a little bit separately in that way.
But you continued with both streams of both work streams.
We did, until COVID came along and hit us with a sledgehammer, like I think most people, especially small businesses, where all of a sudden there was no in-person training, there was no regional training happening for organizations in Korea. And so the training business just evaporated overnight. And that's
I'm surprised it didn't move online.
it moved online, but our belief was in experiential based training, in very much the outcomes that are achieved by people co-locating and experiencing training together in the same space. And so that's where we then we pivoted into more of the recruitment, because it's pandemic proof in that sense.
Interesting.
It's like you said, adjusting and you know, going down different avenues that we didn't expect as they present themselves. I think textbook wise it's called emergent strategy, which is just a nice way of saying being flexible and taking things as it comes. Kunal, I think we have run out of time now. I really want to appreciate to you for speaking with me today on the podcast. I really appreciate sharing all of your insights across all the different areas of your life and professional career. Thank you so much.
Thanks Gordon. Thanks for having me. I hope I was fluid enough. I felt I was pretty stiff initially. This was my first podcast, but no, it's been enjoyable. You definitely made me feel comfortable as the podcast went on.
I don't think you were stiff at all. I think you provided us with a very colorful range of answers. And like I said, the first guest to actually give us a quote like that. So that's good that you achieved a guest first on the show. So yeah, thanks again.
Thanks so much, Gordon.
And everybody, thanks for listening and watching to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and have some great takeaways. If you are not yet subscribed, please do follow us. We're available on all the major podcast platforms and also via video on YouTube. Just look up Get Stuff Done Gordon and you can find the podcast, which is the Get Stuff Done podcast. And remember, let's get stuff done. Thank you for listening to the Get Stuff Done podcast. If you would like to be a guest in the future, please do reach out. Or if you would like to recommend someone, that would be awesome as well. Make sure you keep listening, as we will be bringing you fresh insights every week, because getting stuff done is something everyone needs.